It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
With a hip and a hop and a hip and a hop and something. I completely lost it. It's a hip and a hop and the, anyway. Welcome to Money for Lunch. Kind of starting off on a strange note there, but hey, that's what happens. So I got this thing, this rapper delight stuck in my mind. It's a hip and a hop and you throw your arms in the air like you just don't care. And the chick, anyway. All right. Well, good to have you guys here at Money for Lunch. Sometimes it's a strange and wonderful place. So I appreciate you stopping by. Appreciate all the good feedback. I appreciate you guys interacting with me on Facebook. Now some of you guys have found us on Instagram and on Twitter. We thank you so much. We thank you so much for supporting our Facebook page. We get some of the best show ideas and suggestions from you, our loyal listeners. Thank you so much. And we're going to, you know, get this thing rocking and rolling here. Elizabeth Becker on the show talking about being overbooked, exploring the business of travel and tourism. Robbie Hardy also on the show today talking about upsetting the table, doing some girl-on-girl business. I wanted to go someplace else with that, but it just didn't come out as funny as I thought it was going to be. Anyway, upsetting the table, talking about myths and the reality of females in the workplace, a really good book. And then wrapping up the show today, we're going to be talking with Mahovan Rajaraman. Probably killed the guy's name. Sorry about that, Mahovan. But anyway, he's got... what do you call it? We're going to be talking about monetizing your consulting company. Just a really good show. I'm excited to get into it. I'm excited to have talking with our best-selling author, Elizabeth Becker. She is the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism, which was Amazon Book of the Year. She is an award-winning journalist who was the international economics correspondent for the New York Times, senior foreign editor of National Public Radio, and war correspondent of the Washington Post. Her website is elizabethbecker.com, elizabethbecker.com. Elizabeth Becker, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
You bet. You know what? I'm excited to have you here. So let's get into this. Most people think of travel as a hobby, yet travel and tourism has become one of the top global industries. Talk about this. How did this happen?
It was travel and tourism was one of the surprise successes of this globalized world. When, as you noted, I was covering international economics at the Times and during the whole globalization movement, and we were all surprised that all of a sudden, travel and tourism, which was, you know, something you did in August, was becoming this huge business for two reasons. First of all, something that should have just stuck us in our heads right away, borders were opening. Half of the world, by 1995-2000, half of the world that had been closed off to travel was suddenly open. Just think of it. All of the Soviet Union, which is now Russia, Eastern Europe, all of China, most of Asia had been more or less closed off. All of a sudden, this is open. And then secondly, you know, this is 21st century is global and it is technology. And that means that the internet brought travel much closer. And, of course, transportation. Just think, now you can get from Abu Dhabi to Chicago. This is extraordinary. All of this means you have the means for open borders, technology, and then finally, you have the rise of the middle class, and that is all the trade that happened. And China alone, the middle class is exploding. count India, count all the other European countries that joined the market. So you have this the perfect storm for travel and tourism to go from an afterthought to one of the top industries in the world, and that's $7 trillion. It is also the biggest employer in the whole world. That usually,
wow, that's
when
amazing.
That's one of those party stumpers. What industry most has more employees in the world? And you'll get everything from health to goodness knows what, oil, energy, and in fact, it's travel and tourism.
Wow, that's amazing. And you're right. And I think that even more and more, you know, we see it every day, more and more things are opening up. Cuba just opened up a few months ago, right? Or is it
right,
it's been a
exactly.
year already? I can't remember, but it's opening up. Who knows what's going to happen after that? And, you know, what's amazing to me is, especially living here in America, how much of America I haven't seen, much less, you know, I mean, I have traveled to Mexico a few times. I've traveled to Europe a few times, but I'm always amazed of how little travel I've done here just in America.
Mm-hmm. And you are not alone. America, sadly, is the only country that does not have a federally mandated vacation time. Sad, sad, sad.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans are the most likely not to use the vacation time they have. Something that, who knows, may change or may not. But the first place most people go when they start traveling again is within their country. And as you know, the continent-sized United States, we have some of the best by far. So you could spend the rest of your life exploring the United States. Of those 1 billion trips that you mentioned, those are 1 billion trips across foreign borders. If you counted the number of trips people take within their countries, like we Americans or our neighbors to the North Canadians, that would make to upwards of 4 billion trips a year. That's how much
wow.
we travel. That's how much we
That's
travel.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Let's talk about this real quick. I want to get your thoughts on this. We have this interesting events taking place there in the UK. Brexit now voted
yep.
in the UK just sent the shockwaves through the market. We have all this upheaval in the markets there, the economy. Yet travel and tourism, my understanding, is one of the few industries that could actually profit from this. Talk about this.
Well, yes, and that's one of the reasons why it's one of the few industries that through the ups and downs from 2008 on has continued on an upward spiral, and that's because people come. It's an import. Travel and tourism, is think of it as an import. So right now you're planning your trip, and all of a sudden you're an American. The dollar is really strong against the pound. The pound just lost 9% against the dollar, and it was already weakening. So now you can get so much more out of your trip to Great Britain. In fact, people are starting to buy pounds even before they go there out of fear that the pound might become stronger. So what is often the problem for the country is the advantage for the tourist, because the tourist can go in and say, hey, my dollar's strong, I can upgrade that hotel, I can go an extra weekend because my money will go faster. And that's one of the reasons that will be good. Now, the flip side is that some of the low-cost carriers like Ryanair out of UK, they are not going to do so well because they're going to be hit from the other side. And so, but overall, often the problems like the catastrophe that's happened in the UK because of Brexit, that will bring tourists because of their money and the opportunities.
Yeah, that's amazing. And this idea, this opportunity to take advantage of a weaker pound is I like your thinking there. What an exceptional time, it's just one of those realities. Things happen. I mean, sometimes the dollar's weaker, but right now you're right. You could buy the pound. You could do the same thing. I think. With a couple other countries where their dollar is weaker, and then you could, you can snap it up.
Well,
take it.
Just recently, all the problems in Greece The tourist industry has kept whatever is going is one of the few good points in the Greek economy still to this day. And again, you will find some of your best bargains for sun and island hopping in Greece, and they are getting more and more tourists. So that's the upside of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's that. I like that. I like that. And this is one of those things where a lot of people don't really think about when they're, when they're considering where to travel. Something that that they should take into consideration. Let's talk about this. The major downsides of travel and tourism are its effect on the environment. You know, people talk about carbon footprint, crowding, and local culture. Talk about that. What are examples of this that can illustrate the problems?
Well, easily in anybody's top five most beautiful cities in the world is Venice. Venice is out of it's almost fairy tale. It's so gorgeous. But now the canals, there's no cars. You think it'd be perfect? Well, in fact, tourism is on its way to really destroying it. There are no cars, but the city has allowed all of these cruise ships to go, and they have they land there, they're docked right there, they keep their engines going. One medium-sized cruise ship can pollute the air of Venice more than 1,000 plus cars, and you could have 7-8 lined up. You also have tour buses coming in with thousands and thousands of tourists every single day, so that there are millions, over 20 million tourists come to Venice, which is the historic city, which has a population of under 60,000. So crowding. And that does two things. It not only makes life miserable, but it also means rents go up because you have all these people who want to sell things to these tourists. And
sure.
Venice is losing its clinics, its green grocers, butchers, all the things that keep it a real living city, and it's losing its natives. They can't afford to live there anymore. I mean, if you know the story of Aspen, you know Aspen, Colorado, where regular normal people can't live there because it's only rich people. That's
yeah. In fact,
go ahead.
Just to interject this, I want to illustrate this since you brought up Aspen. A single mobile trailer, not a double wide, but a single wide mobile trailer. It's like $300,000 for the, because of how crazy expensive it's gotten.
Well, whenever you have this gorgeous tourism spot, you have to have really good local government protect the local people because it can be overrun by the wealthy and you'll be shoved out. So that even to the point that one of the most beautiful things in Venice to buy is the local Murano glass. America's most famous glass makers have always gone there to learn how to blow the beautiful hand-done glass works. They're being run out of business because illegal pretend Murano glass souvenirs made in China or Yugoslavia are being sold. Excuse me, that shows not Yugoslavia, but Eastern Europe are being sold as pretend Murano. It goes all those levels, and that's a big thing that is the downside of tourism.
That is crazy, yeah.
Yeah, and it's called being loved to death, and I could give you examples around the world. The Taj Mahal. It's very hard to go there anymore and see much. A country that I know very well and that I write about extensively in the book, Cambodia, it's thrown people off of their beautiful beaches that were supposed to be protected, like our national parks. They threw people off that had their fishing villages, and now they've allowed casinos and seedy hotels on those perfect beaches. Doesn't help the locals, and pretty soon you've got some polluted beaches. There are places in Thailand where they have stopped 100% all tourists going because they were ruining the environment, the water, the reefs, the fish life. And in Italy, there's another part that they have now stopped allowing tourists on the coast. Around the world, you have governments saying, We have to control the crowds. We have to protect the environment. We have to protect our local people and local culture.
Sure, sure. So what's happening at the Taj Mahal? Because, I mean, Taj Mahal is I haven't been there, but I understand. I mean, it's just a tour, right? I mean, so what's happening there that's making it tough?
Well, you have too many tourists. You have so you have health and sanitation issues. You have too many cars coming and going. And you think, oh, a few cars. Well, this is serious car. It's serious pollution, air pollution, and then mixed up with the water of the river Yamuna going, that's polluted as well. So you have a combination of crowds, that sort of thing. And then plus the culture, and this is the part that is a little more ephemeral, a little more difficult to define, but in the old days, I used to be a student there. You could go to the Taj, and you'd hear the ghazals, the beautiful singing in the mausoleum. You could see real craftsmen and artisans making the tiles as they did back in the olden days. That's pretty much disappeared. It's just crowds. Mm. It's just crowds. It's like going to a department store on Black Friday, and what do you get out of it? The beauty, the majesty, it's gone. And it trivializes what was once this stunning, stunning experience. That's what has to be watched with our billions of travelers.
Now, yes. And it's unfortunate what you said, that sometimes these governments, well-intentioned as it might be, you know, they displace, as you mentioned, they'll displace a village. They'll put a bunch of hotels or casinos there. And they, you know, again, they displace the village. They display this personal economy because they're trying to, quote, do the greater good. So that's also too bad.
Yeah. Now, it was interesting here in the United States when we had the government shut down two years ago now. I'm talking to you from Washington, D.C., right? I can see the Capitol from my window. What people may have missed was that the one exception that Congress allowed to keep going were our national parks. That's because it was October, one of the biggest, biggest travel seasons for the parks, and they understood that we would be shooting ourselves in the foot for one of our more important industries if we did not keep those parks going with our park rangers and all the park services and so on and so forth. So somewhere in the American consciousness, they're beginning to understand that you protect what is most attractive and that you safeguard it not only for the tourism industry, but for the future. That was remarkable as far as I could tell.
No, that is interesting. I think that's kind of smart, and it's good to know that they're at least smart enough to think about that. Elizabeth, we're out of time, but the book, again, is Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism, available on Amazon or elizabethbecker.com. Elizabeth Becker, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you, and have a good week.
All righty. Good stuff there from Elizabeth Becker. Interesting stuff, and, you know, I never thought of travel and tourism being the biggest employer in the world. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, best-selling author Robbie Hardy. Robbie Hardy spent 20-plus years, successful years in the corporate sector before finding her true calling in the entrepreneurial world. She has sat on all sides of the entrepreneurial desk as CEO, strategic consultant, board member, investor, and mentor, living her motto, there has to be a better way. Hardy's developed a national woman-only mentoring program called Lessons Earned, which will debut in the fall of 2016. Hardy divides her time between Napa, California, and the Research Triangle Park area of North Carolina. Robbie Hardy, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so Upsetting the Table, tell me about this book. First of all, why write the book, and tell us a little bit about how you came across that title.
Well, I wrote the book because I have been, you know, doing a variety of things over many years and have learned many, many lessons, some easy, some hard, from success and from failure. And they were all sort of bottled up in me, other than when I would be mentoring a young woman in my career. And I always felt that I had a book or two in me to try to get this out so other people could learn from my mistakes and my experiences. And so I ended up pulling this book together as a fable or a parable versus your typical business book, because I think people learn by, you know, examples, and you can refer to, well, you remember when so-and-so did this or somebody did that. So the book is a business fable that takes a young, inexperienced product manager and pairs her with a strong, experienced mentor. And as she progresses in her career, she faces a lot of hurdles that I face and that I'm sure some of your listeners face. And so she uses the advice of her mentor to navigate these, and so it's told as a story, and the characters are Jessica is the young businesswoman and Liz is the mentor. And so you follow Liz and Jessica through this path as Jessica makes her way forward.
Gotcha. Okay, let me ask you this. Let me start off by asking you this. I know a while back I had seen a report that women are being paid approximately 70% of what men are being paid for the same job. Now, I read that a few years ago. Is that still currently what's happening today?
Yeah, it is still what's happening today. It's about, you know, you get data from 70 to 77%, but it's still, yes, there. It is not an equal paying or playing field, so to speak. You know, the salaries, and you see some of it, you know, now becoming more public in entertainment, where a lot of actresses are speaking out, because when Sony got hacked and the salaries of the actors versus the actresses were made public, all of a sudden that brought that to the forefront. So that's helpful so that it brings it to people's attention. But it's really in the corporate boardrooms and in management all over the world that we have to start paying attention to equal pay for equal work.
Sure. Yeah, and I agree, because it shouldn't be based on the gender. It's got to be based on the value that you're bringing.
Correct.
All right. So,
and I think – go ahead.
I was going to let you finish.
I'm so sorry. Yes, I think that that women, you know, bring the value. Interestingly enough, I think it's, you know, women – girls are – you know, taught to be polite, much more so than boys. Boys will be boys kind of goes along. So they're kind of encouraged to be bold. And girls are encouraged to be polite and demure. So when you're negotiating a salary, that's kind of, you know, that's a conflict that makes that much more difficult to be bold. And so that's part of what, you know, women mentoring women can do, because there are ways to, you know, help women learn to be bold and to take their seat at the table.
Sure. Now, also in the book, you talk quite a bit about, you talk or illustrate in the book, in the fable there, that women face this uphill battle. We just talked about the salary. What are some of the other things that they're facing? What are some of these other odds that you mentioned in the book?
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, getting women to be treated with respect, it's been a boys' world, a men's world for a very long time. Now, I was always the only woman when I was starting in my career for many, 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 many years. And it's hard for women sometimes to be treated as equals. Men aren't used to working with women. Women aren't used to working with men. I'm not making excuses, but there is a learning and growth period that has to happen on both sides. Women often instead of just answering the question or saying, here's my idea, and just say it, they, well, go on into all the research they did. They try to justify it. Meanwhile, everybody else is bored. They get interrupted, and somebody else claims their idea. So a lot of it is style and how we communicate. But at the end of the day, you know, women are as capable of men, and they need to be taken seriously. So, you know, there's a lot of pandering, and, you know, someone might, if a woman is passionate, then somebody might, a man generally will say to her, well, why are you so upset? Well, she's not upset. She's just passionate. You'd never ask a man why he's so upset if he's pounding his fist and screaming and yelling. So it's those double standards that, you know, sometimes come into play that, you know, have to be dealt with.
Yes, yes. I think the latest thing I've heard that's kind of interesting to look at the double standard is mansplaining.
Yes, mansplaining. Well, and the mansplaining and womansplaining are very different. And so that's the other issue. That's another one of these double standards that come in, and now there's some humor, you know, that's added to that, which is, I think humor is important. Well, this is a very serious subject, but you have to have a sense of humor to be able to kind of get through the maze sometimes. And getting women to not take things personally is also, you know, a lesson to be learned, because men tend not to take it personally, or they're able to separate it and keep it in the boardroom and then go out and play a round of golf together. And that's something that women, you know, have to come to terms with also. Doesn't mean they have to have it that way, but that's,
right.
You know, if you're working with a lot of men, that's how that path goes.
Yes. Yes. And you know what? And I think it's also different. I think guys, you know, have to realize that in my experience, women speak a slightly different language. Like, you know, and so sometimes I've noticed in my experience anyway, the slight difference really causes a lot of miscommunication. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to be married for 30 years. We have a total of 5 kids, 3 girls, 2 boys, and I'm able to see it. And I'm also, one of the fascinating things that I've noticed is, again, even kind of what you talked about, where we have this male-dominated society, and men, even young boys in school can behave a certain way, and it's accepted. If girls behave that way, they are sometimes criticized for it. I've seen that for
Absolutely.
Myself. We've always taught our girls to stand up for themselves and stuff like that. And so our youngest kids happen to be twin girls.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, we had this incident a couple of years ago where a boy was kind of bullying one of the twins, and of course the other twin stood up to this boy, and so it was interesting to see how the school handled it, because I think they handled it differently because it was a girl standing up to a boy versus a boy standing up to a boy.
Well, she did.
And
she hit him.
She did.
Okay. Well, I figured that's what happened. So she hit him. Yes, and they had no idea what to do. It's
They were like freaking
right.
out, and so I brought up the fact that I thought that there was this double standard there, and what was even more interesting is that the principal involved was female, and I still brought up the fact that I saw a double standard, the girl, my girl, acted correctly. She stood up to somebody who was being a bully, anyway, so it starts at a very young age.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it starts actually when you hear the word "it's a girl" or you hear the word "it's a boy."
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, society has, you know, been, we're changing, but it's going to take some time. But if we could begin that early to recognize them as equals and not treat them so differently, and get them started off in such different paths, it would certainly be helpful. But, you know, you do see a lot of very strong young women who think the world they can do anything they want in the world. And, you know, that's a great attitude. Unfortunately, then they, you know, find some brick walls ahead of them. But there's ways to go over or under or whatever. You don't always have to go through the brick wall to get where you're going. And those are some of the points that, you know, those are the kind of some of the kind of tricks of the trade and secrets and how do you, you know, how do you find your success that we talk about in the book.
Absolutely, absolutely. The book, again, is Upsetting the Table, Women Mentoring Women. It's a business fable by Robbie Hardy. Robbie, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back and talk more about your book and about what's happening out there and how to really overcome some of this stuff, because we didn't get a chance to talk about that. Robbie Hardy, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you so much, and I'd love to come on again. And the book's available on Amazon, but it's talking about this subject is my passion. So you let me know when you're ready, and I'll be there.
All right.
Take care. Have
thank
a great day.
Thank you so
day.
Much. You bet.
Bye-bye.
Good stuff there from Robbie Hardy on, you know, how to overcome some of these situations, not only in the boardroom, but sometimes really in the family room. Again, the book is called Upsetting the Table. We're going to take a quick short break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Broderick. Broderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
How could I resist?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Bum, bum. All right, we are back. My next guest, Madhavan Ramajan. Madhavan Ramajan is a co-author of Monetizing Innovation, How Smart Companies Design the Products Around the Price. He's a board member and partner at Simon Kucher Partners based in San Francisco, Silicon Valley area, advising companies of all sizes from Fortune 500s to startups. Ramajan has led more than 125 monetization projects for the internet software technology clients, helping bring numerous new products to market. And you can find out more by visiting monetizinginnovation.com. Madhavan, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much for having me in the show.
You bet. You bet. All right. So talk about this. I always like to ask my authors, why write the book? What was the inspiration?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look around today, I mean, innovation, it's a clarion call for every business in every industry, you know, every part of the world, pretty much. I mean, innovate to survive is something that you routinely hear nowadays. But, you know, innovation success measured in dollars and cents still remains elusive. You know, and put in other words, most companies, you know, try to innovate without really knowing whether they can monetize on their innovation. 70% of companies fail to monetize their innovation or simply build a product that they should not have been, you know, built in the first place. So it's in a lot of ways, it's wasteful. It doesn't have to be this way, and it needs to change. And given who we are as the world's largest, you know, monetization strategy consulting firm, and having done more than 10,000 projects in monetization as a firm, Simon Kucher, we decided to write this book because we wanted people to have their, you know, billions back and, in a way, you know, monetize with confidence around their innovation. So the CEO of the company, George Taka, and myself, we decided to write a book. And that just got launched in the market 2 months back.
Gotcha. All right, so let's talk about this because you said something that I find very interesting, and this does happen a lot more than we think it does, and that is somebody will launch a product, and because they failed to do the research, the product fails. They don't have the market they thought they did. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. A number of innovations, every innovation rather starts with a lot of excitement. Right? I mean, there's an excitement around an idea. The innovator is, fascinated with it and really wants to build a solution. So it starts with the right intentions. But what happens next is interesting. Many innovations are built in isolation of customer feedback. What that really means is you build products, you design it, tweak it, and you build it to perfection as defined by the innovator. And then pricing is almost a afterthought in these kind of companies where you build a product, you're ready to launch it, and then you're like, oops, we need a price. And companies slap on a price, launch the product, and hope to sell the product. So they hope for the best, but they truly don't know if they can monetize. The core reason behind this is because they never had the willingness to pay conversations with customers, trying to really understand whether what they're building is of value, do customers need it, and more fundamentally, would they pay for it? And if so, what would they pay for it? And absence of this information, they're pretty much operating in the dark and hoping for the best. They truly don't know.
Yeah, that's amazing. So how do we avoid that big mistake?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can probably talk about how to avoid this using one of the stories that we actually describe in the book. The number one way to actually avoid this whole situation is to have the early willingness to pay talks. We talk about Porsche as an excellent example of a company that did this. Back in the 90s, they were driving off a financial cliff, if not at 200 miles per hour, pretty fast. And they needed something new to really survive in the market. What did they do? They said, okay, maybe we should think about an SUV. But an SUV for Porsche, SUV for Porsche, that kind of didn't make sense. What they did was fascinating, right? I mean, they went and validated the market, whether there's an appetite for a Porsche SUV. And to their pleasant surprise, they actually found out that there is. But what followed next was even more fascinating. They actually went and validated every single feature that needs to go into the SUV tried to understand whether people need it, do they value it, and would they pay for it. So things like, for instance, a 6-speed manual transmission. In an SUV, people didn't want it, so it was out, and they were not willing to pay for it, so it didn't make it. And things that were, against the grain of most German engineers, like a big cup holder, that made its way in because customers said they wanted it, they needed it, were willing to pay for it. So and so on and so forth. And every feature that went into the SUV was actually, tested with the customer before even the, basic sketches were drawn for the product. And what happened was the result of it is stunning. If you fast forward to today, they sell more than 100,000 units of this SUV. It's called the Cayenne, and it's a roaring success in the automotive industry and accounts for more than 50% of Porsche's profit. And what they really did for that innovation was design the product around what customer needed, what customers valued, and what customers were willing to pay. In short, around the price, as we like to say it.
Yes. And to me, this is a great illustration of doing it right. Because first of all, when I think of a Porsche, I don't think of an SUV. So I personally would not, if I'm shopping for an SUV. Matter of fact, it's interesting because I am in the market to buy a car, and I looked at SUVs. Porsche didn't come on my radar because it's not. I think that this is a brand kind of one of those things that may hurt a brand, and we won't get into that. But I do like the fact that they took the time to interview the customers and identify what the customer wanted. And therefore, they built it around what the customer wanted. And that's why it was successful, even though it's an SUV versus what you commonly think a Porsche should be.
Yep, absolutely, you got it. That's and I think it all started with having those conversations early before building the product, and then building the product around that kind of information that really maximized the odds of success.
Yes. All right, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about you talk about 9 steps to integrating a successful program. You talk about your 9 steps real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talk about a 9-step integrated framework to really, monetize innovations. It starts with having the willingness to pay conversations early, all the way to, defending your pricing and maintaining pricing integrity after you launch the product. Most of these 9 steps are counterintuitive to what most people perhaps, learned in business school per se. And it's really important for keeping in mind in terms of monetizing innovation. Give you an example. For instance, one of the steps is to really focus on how to charge, because we find that how to charge is way more important than how much you charge. And we give an example of Michelin as an example in the book, which, they built a tire that lasts 20% longer than normal. And tires are probably one of the most commoditized industries. If they go and ask for a 20% premium because their tires actually last 20%, there's no way they would have actually gotten it. What they actually did was they charged based on a per kilometer instead of a per tire basis. And these were tires for people who are trucking different goods from point A to point B. And the results are stunning. The tires lasted 20%. They got their 20% back. And is an excellent example of how you charge is much more important than how much you charge. And then we talk about other steps, such as really understanding what your customer segments are, identifying whether there's a market for the product before building it, and then productizing around the needs, the values, and the willingness to pay of your customers. And all these 9 steps are an integrated framework. And we describe how they actually link to each other in the book in detail.
Yeah, I like this. I like this idea because, again, the strategy of how to charge versus how much to charge, especially when you're in a situation like you mentioned the tires. It's such a commoditized environment. So, same thing with let's say the pizza industry. Is very commoditized. People don't care. They just want to, what's the best deal you got going? And so you have to find, I think, new strategies for that. What are some of the other strategies? So we have how to charge. What are some of the other strategies of this framework?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the other keen insights, when we talk about segmentation most companies actually say that they segment their customers or understand their customers in terms of segments, but they hardly use that information to productize around those segments. And the reason is because, companies think of segments as demographics. So I'll give you an example. If you think of a male 60 plus years old, has 3 children, lives in a castle, is really wealthy, and is in the United Kingdom. You probably thought about Prince Charles, but then that description also fits Ozzy Osbourne, right? I mean, chances are if you segmented your customers based on just these kind of pure demographics, you build a product that needs to resonate with the Charles and the Ozzy Osbournes of this world. And my bet is that they probably have different needs. They value different things, and they're willing to pay differently for those needs, right? So what
Sure.
this really tells you is what this really tells you is that rather than using plain demographics about customers to do segmentation, companies need to think about, what do people really need, what do they value, and use that information to actually segment so that they can then build a product that is aimed at each segment, so people can truly get a product that is something that they want, and validate this information before launching the product. So that's another important lesson as well, not to just fix on demographics, but based on needs and value.
Right. And I like that because, again, kind of with your Porsche story, you have to really know what your market wants. You know, I think of Blockbuster Video. Blockbuster Video at one point was the leader, the international, the global leader in the entertainment rental industry, right? You know, they had like 4,000 or 5,000 stores.
I have to remind some of our younger associates that Blockbuster existed.
That's right. You know, and because they fell in love with their own product, their own leadership, if you will, their own company, they just thought hey, we're the biggest leader in the marketplace. You can't hurt us. 10 years from the first time they met with Netflix, they went out of business because they stopped segmenting, they stopped listening to, and they stopped loving their audience.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at Blockbuster of those days, I mean, the pricing model was quite complex. I mean, they used to charge based on which genre of movies people used to take. There was all kinds of hidden fees and late charges. And I, for one, I paid them a lot of hidden fees that I really didn't want to. And then in comes Netflix, which reduces, you know, the price differentiation, makes the offer really simple, and increases the price transparency, and it has like a, you know, one price regardless of how long you keep the DVD and return it. And it's a huge success because they did away with the pain using a monetization model that totally made sense. So again, an excellent example of understanding segments and how you charge is way more important than how much you charge.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting to me because when the Netflix model came out, I just thought, man, you know that some of those DVDs are going to get lost in the mail. And they account for that. Now, interestingly enough, I have never rented a DVD from Netflix. I do subscribe to their service, but I've never rented a DVD from them. But it's just because I'm a little bit different that way. But obviously, a lot of people were renting from them. And for our people who don't know this, Blockbuster had a chance to make a deal with Netflix like two or three times. I know twice for sure, possibly a third time, and their egos would not let them. And so, there were some issues there. But bottom line is, this is a great illustration, along with the Porsche illustration, of listening to your audience and really knowing them. So segmentation and really knowing your audience is so critically important, because your audience today may not be your audience 10 years from today.
Absolutely. And give you another interesting tidbit, right? I mean, we go into companies all day long and ask them, for the innovations, do you have a business case for this? The usual answer is yes. And then we say, okay, is this business case reflecting your customer segments? The answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. But then we ask a very interesting question. We ask them, is their willingness to pay, your customer's willingness to pay information in the business case? 95% of the time we hear a no. And then we ask this question, if you didn't know, if you didn't have that information, if I change price by 10%, how do you truly know what the volume change would be? And then there's a pin drop silence, right? Yeah. So these companies are building business cases based on assumptions, and what they are really seeing is what they want to hear, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for every innovation, because truly they had the most vital information, which was the customer value and willingness to pay, missing from those business cases, because they are after the fact in most organizations.
Now, you know what, and that to me is interesting. I want to talk about this a little bit because, you know, supposedly Steve Jobs was famous. One of his famous saying is that if he would have listened to his audience, he would have never made the iPhone. He would have never made the iPod. And I find that difficult to believe because there must have been something there, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know – it seems like ludicrous to create the iPhone if he didn't have something telling him that this is the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the most common question I get when we describe the book, because I think when we talk about innovation, everyone gravitates to Steve Jobs. I think as a society, we love exceptions, right? I mean, we
right.
want to talk about that one exception which actually really made sense. For every Steve Jobs, we have 99 other people that we never talk about, right? I mean, that's so there's a bit of self-selection bias here. But that
gotcha.
Said, of course, Steve Jobs was a product visionary. But I think my hypothesis is that Steve Jobs was not just a product visionary, but he was also a pricing visionary. And that makes a lot of sense because most people only think of Steve Jobs as a product visionary, but not a pricing visionary. What I really mean by that is, you know, when you look at iPhone, the monetization strategy of an iPhone, it followed a classic skimming strategy. The price was launched at a high price for the early adopters, and over a period of time, with different models and different strategies, the price has reduced so that they can penetrate to multiple segments and not just the early adopters. I mean, so right now you can probably go and pick a phone across generations, across different types, across different, you know, storage limits, et cetera, to actually appeal to different customer segments. And coincidentally, Apple was the most profitable company in the world. And that happened because there was a clear focus on monetization, and he was a pricing visionary. And many people overlooked that fact and only looked at his, you know, product genius. I would also argue that, having customer feedback is critical for getting innovation success, because innovators don't really have a choice on whether they're going to have that conversation with the customers. The only thing in their control is when they would have it, before they launch a product and get some feedback, or after launching the product and just hope. So.
Yes. And I like what you said there, that the Steve Jobs is an exception and not the rule. And
yes.
So I'm glad you said that, because we, as you said, as a society, we always like to point out to these things. And yes, you know, it's true that Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and there's another person that didn't finish college and dropped out and became rich and famous. But those are typically exceptions and not the rule.
Yeah. If that was the rule, then we would have everyone dropping out of college and doing what they want. Jokes apart, that's exactly right. I mean, we gravitate towards exceptions, so there's a bit of bias in those kind of arguments. But more importantly, when we wrote this book, we focused this book to maximize monetizing innovation potential for all sorts of companies. And the more you have these conversations with customers, you're not operating blind, but you'd rather see, what the feedback would be. Because even if they
Right.
don't understand your product, it's probably better to understand that earlier on and see how they would react to a product that you're actually productizing before throwing it out there and hoping that it sticks.
All right, we're out of time. Mahavan, it's been fantastic to have you on the show. I'd love to bring you back and talk more how smart companies design products around the price. The book is called Monetizing Innovation, How Smart Companies Design the Product Around the Price. You've heard some of our conversation today, and you can tell that Mahavan and his partner know what they're talking about. They've done this hundreds, if not thousands of times. Again, the book is Monetizing Innovation, How Smart Companies Design the Product Around the Price. Mahavan, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bert, and would love to get an opportunity to be back in the show, and thank you for featuring the book.
You bet. Good stuff there, guys. Just very interesting. I love the part about Steve Jobs being the exception. We got to remember that. We also have to remember that if you really want to make a successful launch, you have to really know your audience. Segment them, survey them, interview them, really know your audience before you launch that product. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.